This week's show is supported by Signature Studio. And I use this myself. If you ever get an email from me, that email signature, it's all Signature Studio. Think about how many emails you send every single day. Each of them an opportunity to compound an impression, tell your story, and position yourself in the minds of the people who matter most. Most people waste this opportunity with a name, maybe a phone number. Signature Studio lets you build an email signature that works for you, featuring live testimonials, your latest podcast episode, a booking link with Calendly, or a rotating banner that stays fresh long after you hit send. It takes minutes to set up, works with Gmail, Outlook, and Apple Mail, and you need no design skills. Your inbox is the most under-leveraged channel in your business. Signature Studio fixes that. Start building for free today at signaturestudio.me.
This week on Building Your Leader Brand, Bob is speaking with Simon Raybould.
Hi there and welcome back to Building Your Leader Brand. My name is Bob Gentle and every week I speak to incredible people who share their secrets to building, marketing and monetizing their expertise and the mindset you need for your business to grow and thrive. Don't forget, if you are new to the show, then I would welcome you to subscribe using whatever device that is in your hand. I don't know how you do it. Sometimes it's a follow button, sometimes it's a plus. I lose track, but it doesn't matter. You'll be able to find it. If you do enjoy this kind of thing, then I will briefly remind you that you can download the Personal Brand Business Roadmap. It's everything you need to start, scale, or fix your expert business. Just visit amplifyme.agency/roadmap. So today, we're really talking about where the rubber meets the road. It's where offers are made. It's where reputations are made. It's where authority is built. It's in the presentation, Simon. Simon, welcome to the show.
I am so much, very much looking forward to this.
So Simon, I've made the rookie podcaster mistake again. I do it a lot of not asking you how you say your surname. I'm going to roll the dice and say it's Simon Raybould. Have I got that right?
Tend to stress the front bit, so it's Raybould, but pretty close. I answer to anything. My favourite is Simon Rainbow, which is, I get that quite.
That would be a good one.
It's great.
Yeah, it's funny. Like I mentioned earlier, I haven't done a podcast for about a month. I'm recovering from what I'm pretty sure was COVID, and even the aftermath of that is pretty horrible. I managed to avoid it the whole way through the pandemic, and when everybody else is better, that's when I start to get it. So apologies to my listener and apologies for to you for being slightly out of practice.
It's fine. It's fine. I wouldn't have known if you hadn't said anything.
So Simon, I'm saying this partly for the listener's benefit because I need to give some kind of excuse for not being around for a while. So Simon, you and I have been peripherally aware of each other for quite a long time now, probably years. And I think I've tried to get you on the podcast once or twice. But there was always a good reason it didn't work. But I'm delighted to have you here today. So for the listener who's meeting you for the first time, can we maybe start with you telling us a little bit about who you are, where you are, and what it is you actually do?
Okay. I am now a professional speaker and presentations trainer. The story to get there started off with a PhD and a research science career of 24, 25 years. And then I got promoted to be center manager of what was then the UK's largest social science research unit, discovered that scientists were god-awful at explaining what they did. So I changed my substantive research to look at how better to communicate, the science of communicating and presenting, if you like. And along the way, I've been a lighting designer for dance company, a teacher, playwright, author, and a fire eater.
The fire eater one is interesting. The scientist bit, I relate to that a lot. I once went to a presentation. Not a presentation. I went, once upon a time in my business, I went to like literally any networking event I could find. And I went to get this, a dinner for the Association of Petroleum Engineers. Mm-hmm. Because I thought that might be a good place to find some marketing clients. My goodness. They had a speaker there who was apparently a legendary good speaker, a scientist. And I could see everybody in the room glaze over as this guy gave his presentation. It was 45 minutes of data, literally data. Some people really enjoyed it, but I really learned in that setting how to never, ever do a presentation. Well, I totally get it.
We talk jokingly, I mean, very jokingly, obviously it's a joke, about something called the sniper slide, which is the slide at which, if you had a sniper rifle, the whole thing would be over. So it's usually about slide six. Is that where you were, at slide six? And you thought, yeah, I've lost the will to live. And by slide seven, you lost the will for the presenter to live. Is that the kind of, was it that bad?
It was. I was literally drooling. It was that dull.
Oh, dear. Yeah, that's the kind of, yeah.
If you're into geology and plate tectonics and the absorbency of rock, it's probably really interesting, but it just was not for me.
Oh, that's the kind of people I work with most, that they are the ones that are incredibly technically good at what they do, but now have to start talking about what they do as well as doing it, if that makes sense. So they're usually first-time leaders or managers who have been, I don't know, let's say an accountant, but now have got promoted, so they are the leader of accountants. If you and now they have to talk about accountancy or whatever it is that they do. So yeah, I feel for the guy. Probably really, really good at what he does, but that's different from talking about it.
And I think this is a really great access point. You mentioned leaders and leadership. And one of the things that I encounter quite often is this transition between I'm really good technically at what I do, and now I want to really scale that up and I want the world to know about it because I want different opportunities and I want to, sometimes it's serve differently, sometimes it's make money differently. But this is when I talked about the rubber meeting the road. You're going to need to make your case and you're going to need to present in simple terms. And this is where a lot of people struggle. It's how do I move from simply transmitting data to engaging people and motivating them to take action.
Okay, I'm going to use an analogy here. Have you got a friend who's into photography? You know the kind of thing where
several.
Okay, and do they do that thing where you ask them about a photograph and they tend to spend 20 minutes telling you about the camera they were using, the lens they were using, the f-stop they were using, the shutter speed they were using, and all you want to do is go, that's a really cool picture of a tiger. I mean, that's it. That's the thing we're talking about here, because whatever it is that you're good at, people want to tend to talk about the techniques that they've used, the process that they have used, but all other people care about is the outcome of what it is that they have done. They might go back to check the techniques for validity, to do their due diligence type stuff, but in the first instance, they're just interested in the outcome. And the analogy I use all the time is just to ask people, if they have ever used an Excel spreadsheet, and of course everybody has, have you used an Excel spreadsheet to sort a column of data? And yes, everybody has. Do you know the actual algorithm that is coded into Microsoft? And nobody does. Do you care? No, of course not. What you care about is you put random data in and sorted data out. That's, you're a user, and all you care about is random data in, sorted data out. Presenting is just like that. It is about creating a black or putting the process that you used into a black box and going, what I do is random data in, sorted data out. But so often, because we're specialists, the process is what we're trained in. The process is what we're excited about. That's what we talk about. And sadly, that ain't what our audiences are interested in at all. Not at all.
So for me, this is really interesting because it gets to, for me, some really powerful experiences. I remember I went to, if this happens to me every time I go to a conference, I think I'd love to be a speaker at one of these conferences. And then I sit down and think, well, what would I like to talk about? And it turns into the unified theory of everything, according to Bob. It's like ultimate process. And as soon as we start trying to exclude process, as an expert, we feel like we're beginning to trivialize what we do. How do you help people move from the unified theory of everything to something that's going to hold meaning for the speaker and so get a desired result?
What you're talking about there is something called the curse of the expert, which is when they can no longer see the wood for the trees, because as you say, everything is connected to everything else. There are a couple of techniques we can do. Some of them people don't like. So quite often I will just go, if you are giving this explanation to your 12-year-old son or daughter, would they roll their eyes? If yes, It goes. If they go, "Oh, Dad, tell me more," then that is the bit that stays. And I'm using the 12-year-old as a tongue-in-cheek analogy, but you get the idea.
Or sometimes I can visualize 12-year-old Sass very well.
Yeah. Don't make me laugh, I'm trying to. The other way of doing that is to put everything you want to say down on index cards, but everything separate on one index, one thing per index card, one fact per index card, one quote per index card, one whatever it is per index card. And when it's out of your head, it is much easier to see the amount of information you're trying to give people. Because in your head, it doesn't take up any space. It's got infinite storage capacity in there. But once you put it on index cards, you can see how much you're trying to give people. And usually that means that the would-be presenter goes, "Oh, blimey, that's a lot." And the second thing then is that they've got a tool by which they can remove it, because they can literally pick up the index card and go, "This index card is not as important as that index card. I'll throw that one away." Or sometimes you find that you can shuffle the index cards around and go, "This needs to go before that. This is repeating that." So you put the index cards on top of each other. You narrow it down that way. But the third, other silly little tools you can use is, "Could I explain this in one breath?" I mean, that's a really silly tool. But if it takes you more than one breath to explain something, you're probably going into, I'm being facetious, of course, but you know, you can see the idea. And quite often a useful tool that is incredibly powerful for people is something called "is like but." And you describe what you do. It is like something the audience already gets, but different because. You know, so Uber, it is like Airbnb, but for taxis. And at that point, you don't need to go into any more detail about how the Uber algorithm works and all of that kind of jazz. Or an analogy I've used quite a lot on stage recently is, cortisol is like adrenaline for the brain. Now, if everyone knows what adrenaline is, it pumps you up, it gets you to perform faster. Cortisol does the same thing for your brain, and you don't need to go into the biochemistry of it. I'm simplifying, obviously, but you don't need to go into the biochemistry of it. If people need you to go into it, crack on. They will ask questions. Trust me, they will ask those questions. But far better to not give them enough and have people ask the questions than to give them too much and to turn them off. Partially because if they're asking the questions, they will only ask questions if they care. Which is, you know, they've already bought into what it is you are trying to do if they are asking those detailed questions.
So something I'm thinking about is, let's say somebody has been given an opportunity to speak. They can go down the rabbit hole of the unified theory of everything, which I think is the expert's first inclination, or they can do what expert experienced speakers do. What do they do?
They ask a simple question. By the end of the gig, what do I need the audience to do different? And everything falls out of that question. So if you are, I've been doing some work recently for the police with the cyber crimes unit. Their presentations until I went there were all about the process of what they, the police, did to harden up somebody's business. Mind-numbingly tedious and fascinating if you're a nerd, but mind-numbingly tedious if you're in the audience. The question I asked them then was, by the end of the gig, what do you want people to do? And the answer was, we want them to download this PDF in order to increase and then action on it to increase the security of their businesses. And once you know what the outcome is, you can work backwards from that. And anything that does not get you closer to that change outcome has to go. It is just like content that's in a hot air balloon. If the balloon is crashing, what's going to get thrown over the side to keep the balloon afloat and get it to where it wants to be? But always for professionals, it starts with what's the end chain change that we're looking at, and you just reverse engineer from there. I mean, it's easy to say, it's hard to do. It's like losing weight is easy, isn't it? It's eat less, move more. Eat less, move more. That's all there is to it. But it's harder to do in practice than it is to actually, to say it.
Listening to that, you could be forgiven for thinking, well, it's just about different facts. It's about being more specific. And one thing I know is that the speakers who can really hold a room, they're not just transmitting information, but they're really good storytellers. And they use story to make points, to illustrate points, and as the vectors for the information. And I remember I've seen a couple of speakers over the years who have built legendary reputations where people say, oh, they're such good storytellers. And it's fascinating to me that everybody has really interesting stories, but if you ask people what are their stories, they have no idea what they are. And I didn't mention it at the beginning, but for the listener, Simon's written at least three books, and the most recent one, Story Making. Now, noticeably, it's not story divination or story collection, it's story making. And I think there's probably a reason for that. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, because I wanted to get people to get the idea that using stories is something of an industrial process. It's not airy-fairy, arty-farty, ooh, I'm going to tell a story. There are sequences of things you can do. I use terminology such as mining, storing, and deploying so that people know it is a thing, it is a resource that they use. But the reason that people think they've not got a story to tell is because it's the same reason that fish can't see water. When you're inside your own life, you don't know what it looks like from the outside. So I've had clients, for example, who graphic designers, I've got to be careful what I say, not to give confidentiality stuff away. And I said to them, have you done anything cool? And they've gone, no, I haven't. I'm just a graphic designer. It turns out they've done the logo for a Hollywood film. But because to them it was only a 20-minute gig, does it worry anybody that Hollywood logos are knocked up in 20 minutes? But to them it was only a 20-minute gig. They didn't think it was a big story to tell. So the knack is to look at your life, as it were, from the outside. And there are simple tools for that. My favorite is just to become your own David Attenborough. Just commentate on your own life, as it were. You know, here we see Simon in his natural environment, sitting in front of a Big Mac computer with a cup of tea to his right. And at that point you go, what happens if a cup of tea falls over onto his, you know, you get the idea and you can start. You know, then you think, okay, there's a story there because I have actually spilled a cup of tea onto my computer and away you go. Or there's a technique from a guy, Kennedy. Do you know Kennedy, the email marketing guy?
Yeah.
He has a great technique, which I've appropriated, which is instead of saying to yourself, what's the most interesting thing that happened today? Because people go, nothing interesting happened today. Kennedy forces them to ask, what's the least boring thing that's happened today? Because by definition, there has to be a least boring. And sometimes you can't use that, but quite often it gives you something. And what I've done forensically in the book is go, once you start to look for these stories and collect them, you store them in a little library. So that at the point when you need them, you're not thrashing around for a story for your presentation or your marketing or, God help you, your cocktail party. You've got a library of these things, all catalogued with, I mean, I'm going to make it sound really forensic at this point, but they're all catalogued with keywords. So you ask me a question about customer service and I go, aha, I have three stories about customer service, one good, one bad, and one that I can't repeat because it's too rude. You don't have to think. They're all sat in your head already because you've been collecting them as the days, weeks, and months have gone on.
It's really interesting. One of the exercises that I get clients to do is related to content. And most people will declare that they're not very creative people and they struggle to come up with ideas for even a weekly LinkedIn post, for example. So I get them to keep a little notebook and every time they have an idea, it goes in the notebook. And what they realize is they have more ideas than they realize they do. It's just, if you don't capture them, they evaporate.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
But there's another aspect to this, which is some people might listen to this and think, Bob, you've gone a bit weird. But anybody who's ever kept a dream journal for even a week will have experienced this, that most people will think, oh, I don't have dreams at night. But you write down even the vaguest recollection on night one. On night two, you'll remember some details about probably three or four dreams. And by the end of the week, you are overwhelmed by the experiences you're having overnight because the brain starts to go, oh, that's what he wants. Here, have it all. Mm-hmm. And it's the reticular activating system in the brain. It's the part of the brain that's job it is to filter stuff out and give us what we need. By physically anchoring this in an object, i.e. a notebook, the reticular activating system and the subconscious can go, oh, all right, we'll give you all that now. And you're doing the same thing with the stories.
Exactly. The RAS, reticular activating system, it's a lifesaver, because if that fails and we try to observe everything that is going on around us, we go crazy really fast. Sadly, this is more personal experience than I want to confess. We go crazy really fast because we just can't do it. So our RAS keeps us focused on the thing that we are supposed to be doing and filters out everything else unless it's an emergency. All the techniques we're talking about here do is bypass the RAS just a little bit so that it starts to pay attention to stuff that is what I'm going to call peripheral to your main activity.
Yeah. And I think that physically anchoring it in an object that's in your environment is a very powerful aspect to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I recommend people use Notion rather than a book because it's online and you can get access to it anywhere, but the principle is exactly the same. Exactly the same.
And I'm guessing this is a scenario that happens fairly often. Somebody gets in touch with you and they said, I've got an opportunity to speak, or I've got an opportunity, or I have to do it. Two different philosophies there, I think. But they've decided they're going to say yes to this, and they have no idea what to do next. How do you help them over that threshold from knowing there's an opportunity to now having a plan?
So there are two different systems. One for if they've got an opportunity that they're looking to take advantage of, that is a different system from the I've got to do it because the boss says so, or it's part of the part of the job, right? If you are talking about the I've got an opportunity, which is typically something like they've got a TEDx coming up or there's a big conference that they want to speak at or whatever it is, it always starts with a metaphorical coffee. If I can, face-to-face, but it always starts with a coffee and the conversation always orientates around the what I call the Gandalf question, which is, if I waved a magic wand and I looked at the world before your gig and after your gig, what would the difference be? What change would your gig have made to the world? It takes usually about 10 minutes to narrow that down because people will always come back with, well, I'd like people to be more aware of. And you go, no. More aware of doesn't change the world. People have got to do something. What is the one thing you want them to do? And by the time we've gone through that loop three or four times, we've got the answer to the Gandalf question. I want them to do X. And then you start just reverse engineering, which is, right, if you want them to do X, what's the step before that? And what's the step before that? And what's the step before that? And pretty soon you've got to the beginning of the thing where you go, well, in order for things 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 to happen, thing number one needs to be, I need to prove to my audience that they should sit down, shut up, and pay attention to me. At which point, yeah, sure, we start talking about your personal credibility statement, which is the way you get audiences to go, oh my God, this guy's worth listening to. And it's almost always the same structure. It's the personal credibility statement, the content credibility statement, the three chapters, and then the wrap-up finish. Now, I say almost because there are exceptions to every rule, but by the time you have gone through that process of, in order to get thing 9 to happen, what does thing 8 look like? What does thing 7 look like? And from there, it is a question, I'm going to say it's a question, just a question of filling in the details, because we always know what each chapter is supposed to have done. And you get to the end of a chapter and you can say, has this chapter achieved target X? Yes. Okay, I can move on to chapter 2. Almost always, it's the same structure. As I say, it starts off with a personal credibility statement because people can't listen. Not won't or don't, can't listen to somebody that they don't think is worth listening to. I took a big risk in a gig yesterday in Ireland where I joked, let us suppose that Donald Trump comes on stage and says, I'm going to talk to you about women's reproductive rights. Are you going to listen to the rest of the presentation? And of course, pretty much everybody just laughed and went, hell no, because he's got no credibility in that field. So you're looking for a very short, four sentence maximum thing that means you, that the audience goes, oh, wow. And once they've done the oh, wow for the person, then you give them the metaphorical, by the end of today's gig, you will be able to. And then you give them the structured content. But it's always about getting the interest set up first so that people want the information. Whereas what most of us do is design our presentations in a way that matches the process of creating the presentation, which is problem, data collection, data analysis, result. Well, as I said earlier on, the only thing the audience cares about is the flipping result. So put that at the beginning. So if they fall asleep, at least they've got the thing that they need to get to it. They shouldn't fall asleep, but in desperation, you know?
Well, I am a particularly laid-back speaker, and so the sleeping is optional.
As long as you're really not like sleeping on the stage, it's all good.
That structure or framework that you just walked through there, is that in your book or is that from somewhere else? Because I haven't heard it put that simply before. Right. And when my eyes water, I know it's an exciting idea.
That's not in the book. That's what I call the story-making system. And if you want the details of that, you have to have me. The book is much more about the collection and deployment of specific stories at a much more tactical level. The system I've just outlined there for you is a much more strategic thing, because I thought that was the question you were asking. But the book is much more tactical. The book is much more about, if you need a story that gets your audience's attention, this type of story is what you want. If you want a story that establishes rapport, that kind of story is what you want. If you want a story that helps people understand, this is the kind of story you should be telling. And by type of story, I mean the different type of hero and the different epicness of the story, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, we joke about something called the dragon scale for how epic a story should be.
I need to write this down.
If you tell a story and you can finish it with, and then I found a fiver, that's what we call a pub story, and that's neither use nor ornament to anybody, really. If you've got an epic story, which can only be topped by the phrase, and you've got to do this voice, or you've got to do the voice, right? If it can only be topped by the phrase, and then the dragons came, then it's an epic story, and it's probably too big. So you're looking for stories that are somewhere in the middle. We call them hope-so stories. Why do we call them hope-so stories? Because with our tongue in our cheek, that's, you know, it's the right size story. If when you're doing the thing the story's about, somebody says to you, are you sure you can pull this off? And your response is, bloody hope so, because I'm going to look a fool if I don't. You know. So, you know, it's stories often are not about the enormous, heroic Lord of the Rings type stuff, because that alienates people. It removes their self-efficacy. It stops them thinking they can do the thing that you are encouraging them to do. Silly, stupid example.
One other question.
No, go on, Bob.
No, go ahead.
A silly example of lacking self-efficacy because the story is too big. My gym, great gym, has free sessions on a Saturday morning, and the story they are going is blah, 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 be an Iron, be awesome, be Iron Man, train with an ex-SAS guy. No. They're different to me. They're special. No matter how much I want to, I'm not going to go to a training session with somebody who used to be SAS because he's too hard. I want
it
somebody.
Will hurt.
Yeah. It will hurt, and I will look like a fool, and I will not be able to do it, and I might even injure myself by attempting to keep up with people who are 30 years younger than me. That's too big a story, if you see what I mean by analogy. Be the SAS is too big a story for people like me who are 62 and weren't ever in the SAS. This is the point where the video goes, but you don't look 62, Simon.
Of course you don't. Before we get into the next bit, I have one more question I want to look at, which is, there are different types of speakers. There are speakers who have to do a one-off thing about a thing, and then there are speakers who do regular signature talks on a regular basis. And my question, I guess, is for the kind of speaker who has to do occasional speaking, how much preparation is too much? How much scripting is too much?
Those are different questions. How much prep is different from how much script? So let me split the difference and talk about the rehearsal process, and that is different from practice. Bob, do you play any musical instruments? I don't know you know anything.
My family would say no.
Okay. So when you are practicing whatever it is you play, what you don't do is play all the way through the piece, get to the end and go, bar six sucked, and play the whole piece again. Right? What you do is you play it through once and go, bar six sucked. You go back and you play bar six at half speed 20 or 30 times till you can't get it wrong. And then you don't rehearse the next 3 minutes of the piece because they worked. And you go to the next bit that was tricky and you practice that over and over and over. Because there is this thing where people go, practice makes perfect. No, it freaking doesn't. Practice makes permanent. Which is intense. You need to get it right before you practice it. But if you use that intentional practice, it's called intentional rehearsal process, it reduces the amount of time you need to spend getting your act together by about a third. But it also means that those bits that used to be the things that you fell over on, you now can't get that 30 seconds or whatever it is wrong because it's on autopilot, right? And you don't sound like a robot. Because you haven't done the whole thing over and over and over and over and over till you've practiced the life out of it. So some bits of what I do when I go on stage, I have literally said once because it worked first time and I didn't need to go over it and over it and over it. Having said that, the last enormous gig I did, I spent hundreds of hours on it because it was enormous for me. But the first time I put it on the floor, I put it on the floor in front of my wife, who is awesome. I love her to pieces. She's just beyond words and measure, an awesome person. But her feedback was, nice ideas, darling, but it's a bit of a car crash. Because she's right. The first time you try anything, it's going to be bloody awful. I'm with no offense intended to you, Bob, go back and listen to your first podcast episodes. They're not nearly as cool as they are now. So there is a question of trading off how much time you put into it. Anything is better than nothing. There is a diminishing marginal returns thing where you can over rehearse. But honestly, I have never met anybody who hit that except the professionals. Because people who are real people who have got proper jobs to do and they're having to speak as part of that job. So it's not their job, it's something they do as part of their job. They don't have time to hit diminishing marginal returns. I have genuinely never met anybody who had enough time on their hands to overpractice. With the exception of professional speakers, of course, they're a different story because they're a special breed and not always in a good way.
And then the scripting question, it's a similar question. How much scripting is too much? I'm guessing it comes down to personality.
The best tool I've ever come across is not to try it. For the love of God, don't write it. Just don't write it because literally different parts of your brain light up when you're writing to when you're speaking. If writing was as easy as script writers make it look, we'd all be script writers. And we're not for very good reasons. Because when you write, you tend to use what I'm going to, with my tongue in my cheek, I'm going to call Latin English. And when you speak, you tend to use Saxon English. Mm. Get the bleeper ready because I'm going to use the obvious example. Right? In Latin, you might talk about sexual intercourse. Nobody in the real world talks about sexual intercourse. They talk about having a fuck because English is two languages sitting on top of each other. So never, ever, ever write it. Okay. Having decided not to write it, the best way to create your, air quotes, script is to say it. Go, did that sound right? No. Say it a different way. Did that sound right? No. And just keep iterating it. A really powerful tool, and I mean a really powerful tool, is to imagine that you are going to make your presentation to a respected, aged, but not up-to-date aunt. you're talking to her. So, you know, you can't take shortcuts. You can't use jargon because she doesn't know what the jargon means. And every now and again, she'll go, "That's all very well and good, darling. But what about?" Because that's what aged and respected aunts do. And the answer to that question, "But what about so-and-so?" That's going to be the next chapter of your presentation. So you have this pretend phone call with an aged aunt, and all you do is subsequently mentally edit out the questions that she was asking, and your end of the conversation becomes pretty much your script. If you don't have an aged and respected aunt, a 12-year-old will do. Obviously, get the 12-year-old's permission first.
And we still have words that need to be stored. So if you're not beginning with the writing, if you're beginning with the verbalization, are you capturing that on cue cards? Are you actually writing that so it's a dictated script, or how are you?
Don't end up with a script. Just don't end up, because as soon as you have a script, you will end up reading it. And a whole bunch of things go wrong. The first is that it sounds like you're reading it. The second is that if you make a mistake, it's catastrophic because you try and recover to the script. Whereas if you have a sequence of bullet points around which you improvise, I mean, you have practiced improvising, so it's not really improvising, it's rehearsed improvisation, if you see what I mean. If you fluff a word, it's not the end of the world because you just keep the sentence going in a way that sorts things out. So if you do need to write it down, it is always a sequence of bullet points. How you record those bullet points depends upon the person that we're talking about and the stage that you are on and all of that kind of jazz. If we're talking about people who are on stereotypically boardroom type meetings, you know, so maybe there's a dozen people in the audience or something along those lines, best place to put those notes is in presenter view on your PowerPoint. So you can see them on your laptop, but they're not on the screen behind you. Worst place to put them is in bullet points on your slides on the screen behind you, because you'll know as well as I do, people read up to 10 times faster than you speak. So by the time you've got to bullet point 4, they've read all 32 bullet points and they're just sitting there waiting for you to get to the point, and they just want you to die of a heart attack so they can go home at that point. If you can't use presenter view, put them on index cards so they fit on the inside of your hand. The beauty of that is that index cards come in different sizes. So if you've got big hands, you can use 6x4 index cards. If you've got small hands, you can use 4x3 index cards. I don't care what. So it's something that sits on the inside of your hand so that you can still gesticulate and it's there. But the beauty of that is you can go walk about on the stage. You're not tied to the podium. But honestly, hand on heart, the process of creating your air quotes here, script, air quotes, embeds it in your head so much that you don't need the bullet points. And I've used the word head there advisedly because it's not your head, it fixes it in. Speaking is a physical act. You can't rehearse it in your head. You rehearse it out loud. So by the process of going, "Ladies and gentlemen, I want to talk about X, Y, Z." "Oh no, that's crap. I'll say something different. Good morning, everybody. Today we're going to..." Right? By the time you have said it over and over and over, you've got a muscle memory. Now, I know muscle memory is not a real thing. Don't come at me for that. I know it's not. It's actually in your head, not in your muscles, but it's embedded as a schema within your head. So it's the metaphorical muscle memory.
So I found this really, really useful because there are some very well-known public speaking coaches who will tell you you need to script things. And for me, this is not ever going to work. I have a good friend who does script all the talks that she gives, and she's phenomenal at it. She does a really good job. She can stick to her script. I find it just throws me off and I end up overthinking it and get paralyzed, and it's almost impossible to deliver. The style that you're describing there, where you have almost mental wayfinding rather than a script, is much more realistic.
Much more realistic for people who are not professional actors and things. Now, I can do a script because I spent years touring as an actor, so I've learned how to do a one-man show for an hour. If I can remember a one-man show for an hour and a half script, I can remember anything. But honestly, the hardest gig I've ever done was my TEDx, because that was pretty damn scripted. And I had to get it to the script, because the script had been approved by the TED bodies. And if I went too far off that, it wasn't going to make it onto the TED website. But for normal people, I think I've just called myself abnormal, you know what I mean? For people working in normal circumstances, it's not viable to try and learn a script. It's too much like hard work.
Yeah. Well, I actually leave this conversation feeling much freer about public speaking than I did before. I think a lot of people think that if they're not approaching it the way that we were taught in school, which is you learn your lines, then there's something wrong with us. And I think this is a much more liberating approach, something I feel much more confident to move towards. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah. And the invoice is in the post.
Please don't. So we move into the second part, where we're going to talk about three things. These are three things listeners can just go and take action on today that will help them move forwards in some way. And these are always a treat and very interesting for me. So are we ready? Thing number one.
Let's do the easy one first. Thing number one is a book recommendation. Just go buy the book. If you don't like it, tell me and I will refund you the money. It's a book by David Epstein, which is a bit of an unfortunate name at the moment. I realize that. But David Epstein, it's called Range. And the subtitle is something like How Generalists Triumph in a World of Specialists or something. But it's certainly that film. It's phenomenally liberating and powerful, because it points out that only in very special circumstances does the old-fashioned route of start when you're 12 and just keep going, getting better and better and better and better and better at it actually work. The real experts at what they do almost always got there via a backwards, stupid, you know, a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of the other, a bit of that, and they end up where it's best to be. And the stereotypical example is a fencer with a gold medal in fencing after only 3 years of taking up fencing, which is ridiculous. Until you realize he's been a professional ballet dancer before that, which means that all the work that fencers have to do to learn the steps, he sees once and goes, okay. Because he's got 24 years of experience, you know, the kind of thing. So it's a phenomenally powerful, liberating book.
I have not read that, and I'm going to go and order it this afternoon.
It's not a long book, and it's definitely my kind of book. It's very similar to the types of books I write, in the sense that it sounds conversational, but there's a 400 weight of references that sit underneath it. So he's done his homework. It's good stuff. You can't literally read it in one sitting, but metaphorically, you certainly could give it a good go.
Yeah. So thing number two, I'm going to start calling these amplifier number two.
Amplifier number two is a really, really simple tool. And I'm guessing a lot of people will already know it. It is a tool for reflective practice. So the idea is that when you do a thing, that's a gig or a podcast or a whatever, we're supposed to take just a little bit of time to sit back and go, what can I learn from that? The problem is that most of those tools take longer to do than the thing we've just done. So they never get used. The technique I use and I commend to people is called the Rolf methodology. And Guy Rolf was only one of the three people that created it. I've forgotten the names of the other two, but it's called the Rolf methodology. And it is breathtakingly simple. It is simply to ask yourself a variation of the question, what, three times. What happened? So what were the consequences of that happening? Now what can I do about it? It's so simple. You can spend 30 seconds on it, and that's your reflective practice done. So what happened? My battery ran out halfway through a presentation. What were the consequences of that? I looked like an idiot and my credibility, blah, blah, blah. What can I do about it? Carry two batteries. Obviously, that's a story told to me by another professional speaker. It certainly wasn't me. Just for the listeners, absolutely certainly wasn't me.
I've heard of the Rolf methodology, but I've never actually heard any more than the name.
It's great.
I'm going to have a look at that, because it does sound very simple.
It's just so simple, isn't it? So what, now what? And that's it, done.
I'm sure there's an awful lot more to it.
Oh, yeah, there is. Absolutely. The research behind it goes into quite considerable detail, but the reason I like it and commend it is that the pointy end of the stake is literally those three questions. And you can do it. For me, a tool that you can use in 5 minutes is better than a better tool that takes 30 minutes that you never use. So there are better tools, but they take so much longer that I don't have the patience to do them.
Well, it's the best tools are the ones that get used.
And maybe there are grown-ups in the world who could use the more sophisticated tools, but I am not one of them. As my wife will tell you at considerable length.
So amplifier number three.
Number three. This is a PowerPoint trick. In Keynote, it's called Magic Move, but most people use PowerPoint. And in PowerPoint, it's called the Morph Transition. And what it does is it takes, as you move from one slide to the next, any object that is on both slides, slide one and slide two, if it's in a different position or a different size on slide two, it gradually animates that transition. So if, for example, and this is a crude example, if, for example, you have a list of five things on slide one and you say, I'm going to talk about thing number three now, you click the mouse, instead of going from slide one to slide three, there is a fade transition and the thing number three can slide up to the top of the screen and become the title of the thing you talk about. It reduces cognitive load. It means that people can see the flow of what you're talking about and so on. The potential applications for it are absolutely tremendous because it means your audience can see where you are. And it's, you know, I'm going to talk about thing number one. I'm going to talk about thing number two. And always you can come back to that slide that has got all of your agenda items on, if you see what I mean. Mm. So people can see where they are in the slide, but it's not just a fade transition. It is a move transition. So if it's on the agenda slide and it's, I don't know, 42 points big, it fades up on slide two to be 70 points big because it's now the title and people see that transition, see that animation. Firstly, it looks so cool. I mean, it looks so cool. But secondly, it reduces audiences' cognitive load. There's no stop dissonance is the jargon term for it. There's no point when they go, where are we now? Because they see the movement of these things happening.
And I'm guessing if you're sharing it for the listener, it's probably fairly easy to pull off.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. It is. It is breathtakingly simple. There are videos all over the place about it if you need a video for it. But honestly, if you're halfway competent in PowerPoint, you can learn to do it in about 30 seconds. You just put it on, you put an object on slide one, you put the same object in a different place on slide two, and you tell PowerPoint that the transition you want to use is morph. That's it. It just sits under the list of transitions, just like fade or dissolve or any of the other transitions. And you just click a button and Bob's your proverbial uncle. I mean, you're quite right, Bob. I wouldn't give people anything that was hugely complicated. I was going to say it is idiot proof, but that is somebody out there will go challenge accepted. So I'm not going to claim it is idiot proof, but it is certainly pretty darn simple.
Idiot is relative as well. There's a sliding scale. And I guess it's also situational No, I'm not going to go there.
We're going to get ourselves banned by the FBI at this point.
Well, no, who knows what was about to come out of my mouth. I have no idea. I've had a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed our conversation and I've learned a lot. And I'm actually more excited about going out to present and speak than I ever have been.
It's cool.
Which is a testament to you having done a really good job today. So thank you very much for that.
I think that says more about you, to be honest. I think that's kudos to you for that.
I don't think so. What does a typical client look like for you? If somebody is at home is thinking, I need a bit more Simon in my life, what might that actually look like in practical terms?
They are usually people in what I'm going to pedantically call a liminal space. So they're just about to get promoted or they've just been promoted into a leadership space. And that could be a leadership space within an organization or they've gone self-employed and they now have to lead themselves, as it were. So they are people who are technically really good at what they do, but now have to start talking about it for the first time. I do work with professional speakers, but not often. My big thing is working with people who have got to be speakers rather than people who want to be speakers.
And if somebody's thinking, I'd like to go a little bit deeper with Simon, how can they do that? How can they find out more about you?
LinkedIn is the place to start, or my website, which is egocentrically, forgive me, is called presentationgenius.info. In my defense, it wasn't my idea. I didn't start the brand. It was the publishers. They said, would you write a book called Presentation Genius? And I said, yes. And it became a bestseller. And I thought, given that I've got a brand sitting in the market there, I might as well use it. Presentationgenius.info. But if people want to just download something, and there is no sign up for this because marketing is evil, if they just go
it's not.
I've got a new thing I'm pushing called story making. So if they go to storymaking.business/Bob, storymaking.business/Bob, there's a freebie there for everybody, which just looks at the different type of stories you can get using something called the soap ladder. Stories about yourself, other people, audiences, and implied planted stories. I think it's only about 6 pages long or something, so it's not huge, but it's free and there's no sign up and it's fun.
I will go and get that this very afternoon.
I think it's fun. I think it's fun. I mean, other people might not, but I think it's fun.
Stories are always fun, and stories are the best way to connect, always. And I think that's a universal constant. It has never changed in the last, I'm going to speculate, 20,000 years. So why should it be any different now?
Give or take, yeah. I wouldn't like to put a number on it, but let's just go for 20,000. I think it's probably more than that as well, to be honest. And if you probably, start counting cave paintings as a form of story, then far more.
Well, I had to pluck a number out somewhere, Simon.
Fair enough.
So that does bring us to the end of another episode. Simon, you have been great. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So have I. Thank you so very much.
So that does bring us to the end of another episode. If you have enjoyed this, then I would invite you to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to podcasts. And that's 5, like the fingers on your hand or the toes on your feet. Count them, because it's definitely not 4, unless you've had an unfortunate experience, in which case I feel for you. If you have enjoyed the show, you will also love the Personal Brand Business Roadmap. It's everything you need to start, scale, or fix your expert business. 100% free as a gift from me. Thanks again for listening. Thanks again, Simon, and I will see you next week.
See ya.